Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 29th, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, what cancer and stem cells have in common, demystifying fairy circles, and watching a supermassive black hole devour its prey.
We really don't know exactly how material feeds a black hole.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
In order to make a stem cell, you have to back it up the road a bit, away from its most differentiated state, into something that has more options, a form that can take many different paths. In a review this week, Mario Suva and colleagues discuss how the changes that can reprogram a cell into a stem cell and the changes that make a cell cancerous share a host of players, such as transcription factors and chromatin regulators. I spoke with Suva about these similarities and the ways in which this analogy can serve research and the clinic.
So the idea of this review is to highlight the conceptual parallels between cancer and reprogramming and identify important interrelationship between key players in the two processes. The work that has been done on induced pluripotency and direct lineage conversion have led to remarkable insights regarding the role of transcription factors and chromatin regulators in mediating cellular transition. While this has considerable implications for regenerative medicine, providing a transcription factor code to generate numerous different cell types, we believe this work is also highly relevant to multiple stages of oncogenesis, ranging from the initial cellular transformation to the hierarchical organization of established malignancies.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more in detail about why do we need to talk about cell reprogramming when we talk about cancer? What are the things that they have in common?
So cellular reprogramming, and in particular induced pluripotency, demonstrates the dramatic consequences of deploying gene regulatory mechanism in an inappropriate developmental context. Similarly to reprogramming, oncogenic transformation frequently involves de novo acquisition of developmental programs. Mm-hmm. And there is actually a striking number of factors and mechanisms involved in cellular reprogramming that are now recognized to play critical roles in malignant transformation. For example, many facilitators and many barriers are shared between these two processes. I can give you a couple of examples. Many of the transcription factors that direct reprogram are actually true oncogenes that are mutated in cancer, and many genes that act as barriers to reprogramming are known tumor suppressors, for example, P53, and these tumor suppressors act on proliferation and apoptosis, and by this also impede reprogramming. So this general principle suggests that the epigenetic rewiring that is necessary for cellular reprogramming may be at least in part recapitulated during cellular transformation.
And so how do you see the research going? Do you see that cancer research informing reprogramming for pluripotent cells, or do you see it going the other way, where we're going to learn a lot from reprogramming and apply that to cancer?
I think you can really, both research are going to fuel each other. We're going to definitely learn a lot of the fundamental mechanism through the studies in cellular reprogramming, and cancer research will be able to apply those mechanisms to a given setting depending on which player are actually mutated or impaired in a given cancer situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, your review is titled Epigenetics. So let's talk a little bit about chromatin. What are some of the factors involved in chromatin remodeling or maintenance that are also involved in cancer and cellular reprogramming?
Yeah, so as I've just pointed out, DNA sequence-specific transcription factors are master regulators of cellular state, but they act through recruiting chromatin regulators that modulate the accessibility of target DNA sequence and that impart specific chromatin states. Transcription factor binding is also dependent on chromatin accessibility, and therefore chromatin regulators can act both as gatekeepers that modulate transcription factors' regulatory activities as well as facilitators to their effect. Their contribution to malignancy is really present in multiple modalities. Like specific transcription factors, many chromatin regulators are actually bona fide oncogenes or tumor suppressors that are themselves directly affected by gain or loss of function genetic mutations. And this has been really highlighted by many next-generation sequencing studies in cancer. But even in the absence of direct genetic alteration, chromatin regulators might be co-opted by cancer-specific fusion proteins or by other oncogenic factors to modulate gene expression. Chromatin regulators also play a role in a lot of cancer-relevant processes, including epithelial to mesenchymal transition, senescence, genome stability, and metastasis. And as such, they really have a very general role in cancer. Finally, I would say that their effect is very dependent on the cell context, and that the same chromatin regulator might function in alternative context to facilitate epigenetic reprogramming, to arrest epigenetic state of a progenitor cell, or to perform a differentiation block.
Okay, well, so how does all of this relate to these different types of cells that are often found within a tumor or within cancer?
So there, I think the analogy we've just discussed with reprogramming and cancer suggests that actually alterations in transcription factors and chromatin regulator may represent early events that would render a cell of origin susceptible to an epigenetic rewiring that would be a first step for transformation. And subsequent hits would then confer a definitive transformed state and would determine the dynamic cellular hierarchy within a tumor. And this is probably particularly relevant in certain types of cancers in which there is evidence of the presence of subpopulations that are more stem-like or more primitive and that are thought to be responsible for fueling tumor growth and to resist to therapy. And actually, just as the reprogramming field is deciphering a combinatorial transcription factor code for cellular identity, cancer research is increasingly focused on determining the identity of a transcription factor code that would dictate heterogeneous cellular state in cancer.
So what you're saying is that there are different types of cells in cancer, but they're not necessarily genetically different from each other. There's either a difference in how the transcription factors are working or other epigenetic factors.
There are two layers of heterogeneity in cancer. One is definitely a genetic heterogeneity. There are different genetic clones. Mm-hmm. But within a genetic clone, at least for certain cancers, there is evidence of a hierarchy which is a reminiscent of a tissue, but frequently we don't completely understand the molecular basis for this cellular organization. And some of it will, as for instance, the example of SOX2 that is a transcription factor involved in cellular reprogramming, SOX2 is a determinant of subpopulations of cells with cancer stem-like properties in different malignancies, such as glioblastoma, breast cancer, or Ewing sarcoma. So some of these transcription factors that regulate stem-like state in normal tissue will have the same effect in the malignancies. But we believe that there is a combinatorial code which is dictating cellular state not only in the normal settings, but also in malignancy.
In what ways do you envision this type of research or this analogy between cancer and cellular reprogramming playing out in the development of cancer treatments?
I think a cancer cell, a given cancer cell, is the result of a crosstalk between its genetic mutation and its cellular identity. And depending on the cellular context, the effect of a genetic mutation will be very different. And as we've pointed out, transcription factors and chromatin regulator are determining cellular identity and the differentiation or stemness status of that cell. And while much of the effort in cancer research is to go after the genetic mutations and is aimed at identifying mutational drivers that are responsible for the cancer development and to go after them, it's a strategy that is only applicable if you have a restricted number of genetic mutations and you have good molecules to go after. In many settings, there are just too many genetic mutations and we don't have the tools to go after all these genetic events. And in that case, we envision that by modulating cancer cell identity and modulating the transcription factors and chromatin regulators that confer this identity, it would provide an alternative approach by, let's say, activating a circuit that is independent of the genetic mutation. And if you want, it's an old idea that has been around in the field for a long time. It would be this kind of differentiation therapy in which you change the properties of cancer cells by changing their status, and it has been applied with success in leukemias. I think that's one example, but for many other solid cancers, we don't really understand fully what are the determinants of our cellular state, and the challenge is to first fully dissect the players at stake in each situation.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Mario Suva, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mario Suva and colleagues write about the epigenetic reprogramming of cells as part of a special issue on cancer genomics this week. You can read their review and more from Science, Science Signaling, and Science Careers at www.sciencemag.org/special/cancergenomics. Hey, podcast listeners. This week, our show is sponsored by Audible, and I just want to remind you about a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And of course, we're sharing a few of our favorites. My choice this week is This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession by Daniel J. Levitin. It explores the connection between music and the human brain, not only physically and emotionally, but also culturally. Plus, he was one of the experts in last week's Science Live chat. So it's your pick, Sarah.
Well, I also picked someone connected with Science Magazine, something from one of our news correspondents, Anne Gibbons. She's been on the podcast a few times, and she's an engaging writer and speaker. Her audiobook, The First Human, The Race to Discover Our Earliest Ancestors, is my choice for this week.
Very cool. So, podcast listeners, check out these books and more from Audible. And don't forget to get your free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. A long-standing enigma in biology has been the origin of fairy circles, mysterious bare patches that dot the arid grasslands of southern Africa. They range from 1 to 50 meters in diameter and can survive for decades before growing over and disappearing. All manner of causes have been put forward, from volcanic gases and carnivorous ants to magical spirits and the gods. After dozens of field trips to the region, Norbert Jurgens believes he's found the culprit, sand termites. Jurgens spoke with me about the enormous impact of these tiny insects and began by setting the scene with where and how these fairy circles form.
They only occur in a large belt stretching over 2,000 kilometers from mid-Angola through the whole of Namibia to the northwestern tip of South Africa. And that area of distribution is always very close to the 100 millimeters mean annual precipitation isohyet. So it's obviously controlled climatically. And they can be described in two extremely different ways. The first would be after a good rainfall at the desert margin. At that time, the fairy circle ecosystem can be described as a circular bare patch with a dimension of 1 to 50 meters in diameter within grassland. And it's surrounded by a belt of much higher grasses directly at the margin of this bare patch where no grasses grow. So in this phase, the fairy circles seem to be a gap or even a damage within the landscape because the grass is missing. More important, I believe, is a second description, which is adequate during dry periods, or you can as well say the normal situation in a desert environment. Then fairy circles are a ring of long-living perennial grass plants surrounded by bare soil and desert inside the bare patch and outside as well. So in this phase, the fairy circle seems to be the only sign of life in a desert. These are the two very different images of fairy circles.
So what's actually going on in the soil inside of these fairy circles? You know, chemically, hydrologically, do they differ from the other soil outside of the circles?
This seems to be very important. Inside and outside of the fairy circle, the soil can be quite similar with regard to physical and chemical characteristics. There can be a higher content of carbon and of soluble salts outside the fairy circle, while there can be a higher content of carbohydrates, also gases, for example, methane, and other organic compounds inside the fairy circle. And most important, always, fairy circles contain a lot of soil water. This is a crucial finding. At all time, the water content of the soil was above 5 volume percent of water. That is quite wet soil and allows survival of, for example, termites.
So what's your evidence that sand termites specifically have a close relationship with all of these characteristics?
When screening all fairy circle landscapes from mid-Angola throughout Namibia to South Africa repeatedly over a period of 8 years, again and again, encountering each and every organism that I could see or that left tracks overnight, during all that time, only the sand termite was found in all these landscapes. And not only in these landscapes, but directly linked and correlated to the fairy circle. So these organisms are the only ones always living in fairy circles. That is a very simple approach.
And of course, there's also evidence of their tunneling, their burrowing, their structures left behind in some of them as well.
Yes, and that brings me to the discussion of whether I can really be sure that they are also the creators, the causative organism, in comparison to the alternatives that they are simply attracted by the water, which is always found within the fairy circle. And there I could really see that there are not only galleries and tunnels, always underground, otherwise these termites are extremely invisible. They are sort of swimming in sand without leaving any tracks, and therefore they have not been observed regularly in the past. However, you find their tracks, especially at the roots of grasses, where they develop semi-permanent tunnels and nests, which are characterized by a black tapetum and some other features which make them recognizable. So it's very obvious that they do not only exist there, but they are active, and they can be directly linked to the destruction of grasses, which is the most important initial step, allowing to store water in the soil, because only there the water is not used up by transpiration during the growth of the grasses.
You refer to the formation of fairy circles as ecosystem engineering on the part of the termites. So what exactly does that mean?
Well, ecosystem engineering is defined as a creation or modification or maintenance of habitats by organisms, well, others than humans. And in our case, the case of the fairy circle ecosystems, the termites obviously create a permanent water store, and because of that, as a second step, a permanent plantation of long-lived grasses around that bare patch. And all this permanent assemblage of resources, water and plant biomass, is generated by the termites within a short-lived, short-pulse, ephemeral desert. And this shift of a short-lived ecosystem to a permanent ecosystem is obviously not only to the advantage of the termites, but it turns vast landscapes from short-lived desert into permanent grassland and thereby attracts many, many species of plants and animals, expanding biodiversity enormously around these fairy circles. So in my eyes, this shift from a desert ecosystem that within 90% of the time is nothing but sand and does not allow permanent life of organisms into a grassland which allows permanent life of hundreds of organisms is perhaps even the global masterpiece number one with regard to ecosystem engineering, even perhaps more important than what the beaver achieves that turns a linear river into a lake, which already is a remarkable achievement.
So if this lays the question of what causes various circles to rest, what are some other unanswered questions about various circles that remain?
Oh, there are thousands of other questions. I mean, one question quite close to the ecosystem engineering part is, how can we translate that into sustainable resource management by humans?
Hmm.
I mean, the whole world is thinking about our growing demographic number and how we can deal with the limited resources of the planet Earth. And I think there's a lesson in what these tiny termites achieved. Other research questions related to the fairy circles are partly related to the termites. We look now at the population genetics. The question is each circle a new colony? How long does a colony survive? The longevity of a queen is another question.
Hmm.
Most important, perhaps, the regulation and coordination of the termite activity. We know about ants and termites being superorganisms. However, how do they exactly adapt to a series of wetter and of drier years? How can they adapt the amount of grass they consume and the amount of grass they let remain in the landscape as an insurance for very dry periods? All this is important. And the role of predators. We follow up the question now whether carnivorous ants are perhaps responsible for the death of fairy circles by killing the termite colonies, or whether coexistence between carnivorous ants, which definitely forage lots of termites every morning, and termites is possible over long periods of time. So there's a number of research questions, and I'm convinced there will be numbers of publications in not too distant future.
Great. Well, Norbert Jurgens, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed our discussion.
Norbert Jurgens writes about the biological underpinnings of fairy circles in a report in this week's issue.
Astronomers think that in the center of each spiral galaxy resides a supermassive black hole. In fact, a supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A star, written Sagittarius capital A asterisk, is thought to lurk in the very center of the Milky Way. Despite its proximity, we don't know much about our local black hole. But with an incoming gas cloud and more telescopes poised to come online, we might be entering the decade of the black hole. I spoke with Ron Cowan about some potential pyrotechnics at the center of the galaxy. He started with what we do know about Sagittarius A star.
We know that it weighs about 4 million times the mass of the Sun, and we know that because two different groups of researchers for, I think, more than 15 years have been carefully finding and tracking the motion of stars around this black hole, and that's how you weigh a massive object. You study how rapidly the objects are orbiting around it. We suspect that it spins, and I think we don't really know the spin. It's not easy because the center of the galaxy is a really crowded metropolis. It's jam-packed, full of stars and gas. It's extraordinarily dense. You know, if the rest of the galaxy or the outskirts of the suburbs, this is the big metropolis. So it's not easy to do any of these things.
So it's not easy to tell what's tugging on what when everything's packed.
That's right, exactly.
And so would you say that we know more about Sagittarius A star than we do about other black holes?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair to say. There is another nearby galaxy called M87, and M87, we believe, has a black hole, and it also produces really strong jets that emanate from just outside that black hole. Those jets have really been quite well studied, including by the Hubble Space Telescope. The thing about our black hole is it's the nearest to us, of course, and we can study its environs very well. But the big puzzle, and it remains a puzzle, is that our central black hole is really a pretty dim bulb. It's very quiescent. Black holes themselves sure don't radiate material, but as matter spirals in to a black hole, it heats up and it emits X-rays, all kinds of radiation.
Right.
It's very quiescent. It's very dim.
Well, so there is a possibility that Sagittarius A star will be active pretty soon. There is an alleged gas cloud speeding its way. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And it's not clear, you know, if the fireworks will be huge or small and over an extended period. But I guess in 2011, one of these two groups discovered this apparent gas cloud called G2. This kind of elongated cloud is hurtling, I think now it's at about 2,000 kilometers a second, which is very fast, almost straight into the black hole. People have done simulations, and they think that as this object, it's going into a really dense area, regardless of the black hole, at the center of a galaxy, shock waves might light up that region. Then when it falls onto what we call the accretion disk, we don't know that every black hole has a big fat donut around it of material. This donut really feeds the black hole. And when it falls onto that, there may be some fireworks. And then finally, a third stage, which may take longer, like maybe up to decades, when it goes through that donut just before it disappears into the event horizon.
Mm-hmm. So there's still some discussion of the identity of this mass. Is it a star? Is it gas?
We don't really know what G2 is. Some people think it's a lone gas cloud, and that's it. In that case, it'll be totally shredded by the black hole. Other people think it's material that is anchored to a central star that we can't see. That makes a difference because possibly less material will fall onto the black hole if that material is anchored by a star at its center. And on the other hand, it could mean that that gas might hang around to drop in the next time it goes near the black hole.
One thing you don't know is when this might happen.
That's right.
What are the timelines for it?
Right. Closest approach of G2 could be as soon as this September, and that's already an update because the original paper had said June of 2013. Mm-hmm. But there's some new data from Andrea Ghez of UCLA and her group, and she thinks it might not happen till perhaps March of 2014. Mm-hmm. That could end up being fortuitous because there's a kind of a blackout period where telescopes on the ground really are kind of blocked from seeing the galactic center between roughly October through next February. So the March date could be a good thing. And even from space, the Chandra X-ray Observatory, there's a narrower blackout period for it for a different reason. It can't stare directly at the sun, and there's a point, I believe it's between November 2013 and January 2014, where it can't look because the galactic center and its view is too close to the sun. But again, there could be months to decades of delays at different points. I mean, closest approach may not be when the fireworks are brightest.
Right.
It could be a few months later, or it could be a few years later.
You've kind of described what the potential stages would be for this gas cloud interacting with the black hole. What kinds of things can we learn from watching it get close, fall on the accretion disk, and then eventually be consumed?
Right. Well, I think one of the things is that, and it might surprise people, is we really don't know exactly how material feeds a black hole, because if a gas cloud or a star has a certain amount of what we call angular momentum, a certain amount of rotational velocity, it has to lose that in order to fall into the hole. And we don't really know how that's done, because in order to do that, it has to give up this rotational motion or angular momentum to gas that's not falling in. And we don't know whether that's through friction or some kind of magnetic stresses. And so, for example, the amount of time between closest approach and when it might first fall onto the accretion disk, just the duration might tell us exactly what mechanism is involved in losing that circular velocity. How much the region around the black hole lights up and when might tell us something about why a black hole is usually so quiescent in the first place, and it also may tell us something about the nature of the accretion disk, its temperature or its extent also.
Because we don't know much about how much material is there and how large it is?
That's right. We don't really know the nature of the food supply. We don't know its extent. Some people think this accretion disk might extend all the way to the closest approach of this star.
This is kind of the decade of the black hole. And this is just a beginning, an appetizer for this feast of black hole data.
Right.
What can we expect in the coming years in our observations?
Okay. Well, in 2015, a small group of radio telescopes that are called the Event Horizon Telescope are going to be electronically joined by a whole bunch more. Mm-hmm. That, astronomers think, will enable them to image for the first time the shadow of a black hole. So what's the shadow of a black hole? As matter falls into a black hole, especially just before it, it's converting all its gravitational energy into heat. Heats up to billions of degrees and emits just a torrent of X-rays and other radiation. That light, some of it will just get swallowed by the black hole, and that's actually what one might call the black hole shadow. But light that doesn't get swallowed, that is emitted in maybe the last stable orbit of this material before it got sucked in, we'll be able to see it, and it will be stretched into a halo by gravity. It'll be stretched into a halo around this black hole shadow. It's sort of the swan song of radiation just before a whole bunch of material fell into the black hole, framing the shadow, framing this dark region. And from that, you ought to be able to actually measure the extent of the event horizon, get even a better value for the mass of the black hole, probably probe things about the accretion disk too, but also in a very fundamental way test Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is the theory of gravity, because exactly how this last swan song of light gets stretched out, the geometry of it, is it going to be a circle, is it going to be different? Einstein predicts exactly how gravity distorts, curves space-time, and therefore the things that move through it, like light. So the shape of this, if it isn't exactly a perfect halo or what the shape will be, mm-hmm. should be able to really test Einstein's theory of relativity.
All right. Well, Ron Cowan, thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Ron Cowan writes about the black hole decade in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, I'm Carrie Klein, and I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's going to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So, Dave, in our first story, we've got more on the gut microbiota.
Right. And this is a really interesting story, probably one of the most interesting stories I've seen with the gut microbiome, as we call it. This is the sort of the population of bacteria that live in our gut. A lot of people are familiar with something called gastric bypass surgery. This is where people, usually people that are quite obese, go in and they basically have piece of their stomach rerouted to basically the middle of their small intestine. And what this does is it really limits the amount of food people can eat. And the results can be very drastic. People can lose a lot of weight fairly quickly after this surgery. But one really interesting thing that happens after the surgery that researchers have noticed is that people with type 2 diabetes, the disease vanishes almost immediately after the surgery, which shouldn't happen. It should take a while for the impact of the fewer calories and diet to really kick in. And also the feces of the people that have this surgery, the microbes in their feces tend to be dramatically altered from what it was before.
So this clues scientists in that there is a little bit more going on here than just making the stomach smaller.
Right. It really suggests, or at least the hypothesis that the researchers started out with in this study, was that maybe something about the surgery actually changes the population of the microbes in our gut. And maybe it's the microbes themselves that are making a big contribution to our weight loss, not just the surgery.
Right. So how did they investigate that question?
Well, the researchers actually tested this in mice. They gave mice the equivalent of gastric bypass, which one of the experts in the study says was probably a Herculean task to do this very sort of nuanced surgery on mice. But the researchers did it. And what they found was that, as with humans, the balance of the microbes in the guts of mice that had got the surgery was a lot different than those of mice who didn't get the surgery. It was also a lot different than mice that just dieted, which suggested that it wasn't just the reduction in calories that causes microbes to be different in the guts of people with the surgery.
So how did scientists then nail down cause and effect here with these bacterial populations?
Well, what they did was they actually took bacteria out of mice that had gotten the gastric bypass surgery, and they put the bacteria into mice that hadn't gotten the surgery. And when they did this, the recipient mice lost about 5% of their body weight in 2 weeks. So it's a pretty dramatic weight reduction in a pretty quick amount of time. And this is really powerful evidence that the microbes themselves seem to be dramatically contributing to the weight loss, both in the mice and probably in humans as well.
Okay. And in our next story, the dangers of too much alone time.
Carrie, this is another story about human health, but it's not about obesity. It's about how much time we spend alone and whether the social isolation of being alone or whether the loneliness itself is actually bad for our health. Both have been shown to be bad for our health, but nobody's really been able to tease out what is a bigger contributor to early mortality. Is it the fact that we're physically alone and separated from other people, even though we might be happy being alone? Or is it the feeling of loneliness? Is that what makes some people die earlier than others?
Right. So which is it?
Well, that's what the study was trying to figure out. The researchers looked at about 6,000 British people age 50 and up, some of whom lived alone, some of whom were just very lonely. And they looked at these people over a 7-year period. And basically, they looked at how many people died. And they found that the people that were socially isolated, so the ones that were physically separated from others, from friends, from family, from acquaintances, had a 27% greater risk of dying. And this held even when the researchers controlled for things like sex, age, and other factors that are related to survival.
How did the scientists actually quantify loneliness versus social isolation?
They gave the participants a survey asking questions sort of like, you know, how lonely do you feel? Really trying to get at their emotional state. And what was interesting was that when the researchers looked at these survey results and they said, okay, now we know which people are physically alone, but what about the people that just feel very lonely? They are emotionally very alone. At first, it seemed like the result was the same. 26% had a greater risk of dying. But when the researchers controlled for other factors, that percentage went away, and they found that loneliness really didn't seem to have any impact on whether somebody was going to die early or not. And that showed that it was the physical isolation itself that causes people to die earlier, not the sort of mental isolation or the mental loneliness.
But there have been other studies in the past that do link the emotion of loneliness to mortality and health. How can we reconcile those studies here?
Well, one of the authors of one of those studies actually chimes in on this story and says it could be a cultural issue. Perhaps the British subjects have what's known as the culture of a stiff upper lip. Maybe they are just answering their survey questions differently than Americans do, and maybe that's causing differences in what the British would consider lonely versus what Americans would consider lonely.
So if social isolation actually is a cause of a higher mortality here, why would that be?
Well, it could be as simple as people that are alone are just not getting the care that they need. Maybe they don't have somebody to be able to help them if something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't have that spouse that's telling them to, you know, eat your fruits and vegetables and don't eat so much red meat. So the explanations could be fairly straightforward. What's really interesting about this study is really just sort of teasing apart what it is that seems to kill us earlier. Is it that social isolation or that mental isolation?
All right. Well, very interesting. And our third story may help explain Washington, D.C.'s mysterious exploding manholes.
That is right. Believe it or not, Washington, D.C. has an exploding manhole problem. There have actually been 38, quote, manhole incidents per year in the U.S. nation's capital. And this new study may have solved the mystery.
Okay, here's my guess. Real-life Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
That was my first guess, too. But it turns out it's something a little bit more banal. It seems to be, at least according to this new study, very high levels of methane seeping up from the city streets. What researchers did in this study was they actually drove every single street. They actually say they did this. Maybe they had their grad students do it. Every single street in the District of Columbia and sampled the air. And what they found were that there were thousands of places in Washington, D.C. with air concentrations of methane that were significantly above normal background concentrations of the gas, sometimes as high as 50 times higher than background.
Well, the city was allegedly built on a swamp. Is it just the natural background of the area?
And that was one suspicion they had. Things like landfills and swamps release natural methane. But the methane they were finding was a particular isotope that's found in the pipes of cities. You know, most of the natural gas we use to burn on our stovetops, for example, is methane. And actually, that has a different signature than the methane that comes from more natural sources. And that's the kind of methane that the researchers were picking up. So they really suspect that there's a lot of leaky pipes out there. A lot of the city's infrastructure is a lot older. You've got these rusty pipes, these cracked pipes, and a lot of methane is coming from that. And what was really interesting was when the researchers looked at the amount of this methane in manholes, it was found at levels thousands of times higher than background. Hmm. And they say that probably explains why DC manholes have a tendency to blow up.
Well, other than the potential dangers of these occasional explosions, is this actually dangerous?
The methane itself is not dangerous to human health, although it can promote the formation of ground-level ozone, which can irritate the lungs at high levels, makes it dangerous for people with respiratory problems. But it's not so much the gas itself. It's sort of what the gas can do when it explodes.
All right. And what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about bees emitting electric fields and how they may use that for communication. Also, a story about building robotic ants and why you'd want to do that. For Science Insider, we've got a story about HeLa cells. These are cells that have been made famous recently. They belong to a woman that lived a few decades ago, and they've outlived her. They're a very popular model in scientific laboratories around the world. A group has just released most of the DNA from these cells, the sequence of the DNA, and that's sparking a lot of privacy concerns. Hmm. Also, a story about the future of nuclear research in the United Kingdom. For Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about conservation strategies. Are they really working, or are we failing at conservation? And next week's Science Live is about Jurassic Park on the 20th anniversary of the movie. How much of our conceptions of dinosaurs have changed since the movie came out? So be sure to check out all of our stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Gary.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now, Science Policy from Science Insider, and Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the March 29th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.